Bad guys everywhere. Battling crime all the time, speaking with pauses. That's right, I got a double dog dare to see if I could open up with a haiku. And I just did it. But for those of you that have seen me speak before, I speak loud, I speak fast. I'm like a linebacker coach in the cyber world. But I've got 3 hours of material, so I'm just going to hit right to it and see how much I can get through. Today what I want to do is first start with how are organizations detecting attacks? What are the indicators that made them put their capes on, swoop down, and start responding to computers? Then I wanted to talk about what attackers are doing nowadays, and then end up with what are the things that are occurring that are changing our incident response processes right now, making us up the ante. Just so you understand my frame of reference, in the last couple years, we've responded to ongoing computer intrusions at over 30 institutions, DoD contractor sites, government sites, e-commerce sites, banks, you name it, we've been there. And I had to get my conclusions out because I knew if I tried to get all this in an hour and 15 minutes, there's no way I'd get to my conclusion. So right away, the state of incident response, what are we dealing with? First thing, the sophistication of the attack tools outweigh the sophistication of our response tools. So the folks making counter-forensic techniques are better right now than the folks making the forensic techniques. In other words, we can beat ourselves. The folks that are developing exploits could be government-funded, may not be government-funded, but we can develop exploits in-house, even at my organization, that we probably can't respond to effectively right now. So the sophistication is more advantageous to the bad guys. The reporting requirements, I just want to go over this very quickly. What we're seeing in incident response is the following. What the execs care about when there's a computer intrusion is the following. Do I have to tell my clients? Do I have to tell my shareholders? And what the heck are we doing about it? The technical managers, the next rung down, have to care about the following. We're doing this about it, and they're talking up the org chart, and they're going down the org chart to the technical operators saying, hey, what are we going to do about it? Technical operators have a whole different level of concerns. Are we collecting the data appropriately? Do we know the host-based and network-based indicators of attack? Do we know the full scope of the attack? How are we going to get ourselves out of this mess? But it's kind of interesting to know at the top level, the technical details absolutely don't matter. The incident owners that I've seen lack the org chart position to impact the whole incident response process. And there's a couple of examples of that. For example, a financial institution gets compromised. The incident handlers will say, let's take the compromised system offline. Well, who makes that decision? The incident handlers and the computer security guys, or over here, the business line owner that says, hey, you're not touching my computer, period. And it's been very interesting to see that the business line owners at stovepiped organizations have considerable power in dictating how response is done. There's the academic way to do it, but then there's the business line owner saying, you know what, you're not going to do it that way. And that kind of goes with number four. Diligent incident response does not parallel management objectives. And when I say diligent incident response, I mean the academic approach. We all know that when you're responding to a computer security incident or anything that's unlawful or unauthorized on your network, you want to collect data in a forensically sound manner, go through all that data, come up with sound conclusions that are accurate and documented appropriately. And 9 times out of 10, you're never going to get the time to do that, and you're never going to be given the charter to even do it in a lot of organizations. Problem five I've seen, there's inexperienced personnel. There's not much we can do about this. Not all of you sit at a desk where your job is nothing more than incident response. Every major organization, for the most part, has incident response as an ad hoc job. And you're not just sitting around waiting for incidents to happen. You've got a day job that you have to do all the time, and then if an incident happens, you now have an extra duty. So most people don't get the repetitions they need to practice the skills of data collection, data analysis, making the whole process more scalable. Most people don't get to document it, and then later on I'm going to talk a little bit about malware analysis, because right now one of the big things I see in incident response teams, as the tools being used against us are getting more sophisticated, the incident response teams are taking 5 to 8 days to find the bad stuff on systems, and that's simply too long. So there needs to be a way for someone to quickly identify the malicious code, and you got to be able to say that goes in the good bin as a fair thing to have on your system, that goes into the evil bin of badness, and people need to do that triage fast. So that's another trend. Number six is definitely the case. It's taken a very long time to get information into the hands of the experts. When I look at a firm anywhere from 1,000 folks to 125,000 folks, what I've noticed is there's 10 guys that really know information security great, and you need to get the information they need into their hands as fast as possible so they can start doing the triaging to say, here's how we can handle this incident. And it takes often 2 to 3 weeks to get that information into their hands. What that information might be is full forensic duplications. It may just be log files. It may be, you know, just the router logs, anything, or firewall logs. But it's taken a long time. I made up a word here for number 7, technology widgetness. I get to come in as a consultant, look at how people respond, and then I'm lucky enough that I get to get out of Dodge afterwards, and they have to continue to muddle through whatever their incident's ongoing sometimes. And what I've seen is it's unbelievable how many widgets make up the technology used in incident response. One tool to collect data for this business unit, different tool to collect data in this business unit. This business unit doesn't even collect data in the first place. It's unbelievable. So they're cluing together arguably 7 to 9 different tools to get through the incident response process. Resolution always requires more resources than expected, and that's something that's unbelievable. Day one, if I'm responding to an incident, and if you're ever responding to an incident, I'd recommend you do this right out of the gates. Tell the guys up above every padded figure you can. Sir, this is going to take us 2 years to get through this, even though you might spend only a day or two. Start giving yourself time, because it's unbelievable how long the resolution can take. Once there's a compromise on your network, there's 3 ways for bad guys to get in, whether it's vulnerable services, valid credentials, or the backdoors they placed on your network. All 3 have different resolution to them. One, you're doing attack and penetration testing. For the backdoors, you're doing host diagnostic audits to look at, can you find the backdoors everywhere. For valid credentials, you're doing a whole password rollout. And these things take a lot of time, need to be coordinated, and there's a lot of pain points during that process. Definitely, I already covered lack of formal documentation. It is very rare that I respond to an incident as a consultant, and I sit down with a firm, and I say, hey, tell me what happened. And they say, here's the report. In fact, I don't think that's ever happened. What I get is, here's a stack of stapled together emails and a guy kind of talking haphazardly, sort of chronologically, about what might have happened. Rumor mill starts pretty early, too. Windows has been the primary target in the last, and I wish I knew the exact number, but at this point we're doing too many machines when we respond. But it's over 99% of the systems we're responding to that are compromised are Windows-based systems right now. For those who care, and I guess we're here because we care, we're not seeing any kernel-level stuff. Now, that might be because our tools wouldn't find it, and I'll tell you the truth, they won't find kernel-level stuff right now. But at the same time, the user space stuff we're seeing is highly effective. It's getting the job done, and there's some advantages for bad guys using user space backdoors. Every time there's a new service pack, it could affect the kernel-level backdoor, but it won't affect the user-level backdoors that are effective. So we're seeing very few kernel-level rootkits. In fact, the last one we saw was in the summer of 2004. That's not true. We just saw one. They're Linux-based, though, so we're not seeing it in Windows space. So how are organizations detecting these attacks? I went through the last 50 incidents. I did this last night, and the numbers didn't even change from last year when I did the same thing. Antivirus was the trigger mechanism for 8 of the last 50 computer intrusions we responded to. And what's interesting about antivirus is a lot of times when antivirus triggers, people have the response, thank God antivirus just went off. That means it prevented the attack. And that is definitely not the case anymore. I would argue if antivirus is triggering on a system, I'm going to give you a percentage kind of like the presidential budget here, but I'm going to say probably 50% of the time if antivirus triggers, you have been compromised. There is malware on your system. If someone can break into your system, there is very little doubt in my mind they will beat the antivirus on that system. So we have a couple stats on that. This is stats from a case we started in April 2006, I believe. This is September of 2005. There were 12 different files used by the bad guys. All 12 were not publicly available in the current state. All 12 were not detected by antivirus, and they were basically packed in 5 different ways. They were using UPX, but they're using different versions of UPX. Here's a screenshot of tools that we saw in September of 2005. If you see a lot of these, you can recognize some of these tools. Like you'll see PWDump. Good guys use it. Bad guys use it. You'll see PSExec, because PS.exe was PSExec. That's a sysinternals tool. It's kind of interesting. One of the trends we're noticing that limits the effectiveness of antivirus is you can compress or encrypt your executables, packed executables. But another is, if I'm a bad guy and I break into your system, I'm doing the same things the good guys do. I'm going to break in with valid credentials, just like the good guys, and I'm going to use the tools you use to upload files, the tools you use to download files, and tools you use to execute files. I use the same ones. PS exec, something bad guys use as much as the good guys use. So it's kind of interesting that they're getting under the radar of antivirus that way. Just so you know, for those who care too, anytime you see a file called agent slave on your machine, it's bad. This next slide is June of 2006, and this was an interesting case. I would call this more of in the data pilfering category of cases. And it was, we responded to 12 different compromised systems. And on those 12 systems, we found 10 different backdoors. And it's the same guys. And that's kind of neat because from our perspective, every system that toppled over was compromised. We had new host-based signatures to determine, new malware analysis to do, because if you don't know what their backdoors are doing, then you don't know how to look for them, then you can't determine the scope of compromise, and then you never get the cancer out of your network. So you got to do some of the malware analysis. And what we got here is a cleansed table that was right out of one of our reports, where you can see bad guys using SOX proxies. These proxies had password protection on it, they had command line passwords on it, they had registry values so that they could reconfigure their tools. This is pretty sophisticated stuff, and it was changing every 3 to 4 days. So that means that there's some capability behind these backdoors where there's enough resources to update it, then update it again, then update it again, then update it again. And the signatures are different every time, so it was very hard to track where these attackers had been, where they're going, and how to get them out of the network. None of them, that was the point though, I got a little sidetracked, none of them triggered antivirus. All of them were very, very bad. IDS alerts. If you had to guess how many times IDS alerts threw me into a United jet flying to O'Hare Airport in the last 3 years, well, really the last two, the answer is zero. IDS has not been the trigger mechanism for a couple years for the things that we're responding to. However, IDS has been fantastic once we've responded to an intrusion that's been detected via other means, and we've said, here's the network-based indicators of this attack. Command shell's going out with a prompt that says Microsoft version 5.1, whatever that network-based signature is. Then we go to the IDS structure, tweak all the sensors, and then it's kind of like a Christmas tree with the light bulbs lighting up. We see all the compromised hosts pop up in the sensors. But IDS has not been the trigger mechanism. Clients outside the company, arguably the worst trigger mechanism from an organization's perspective, because you're sitting at work one day, suddenly your phone rings and it's somebody else telling you you've been compromised. Right away, the incident is out of your control, and that's very frustrating. That's happened 8 of the last 50 we responded to, where someone outside the organization was telling the organization, you've got a problem. Most of them, it was law enforcement, but here's an example that came up December 23rd of 2005, where it was a client calling a bank. In the screen that shot that you're looking at, this is a window that popped up into a woman's browser. The woman happened to be connecting to her online bank, so what does she think? The bank's been compromised. So what does she do? Starts the fire, calling the bank and calling everybody. And the bank called us to say, prove to this woman she was compromised and it's not our server. And right now that's the hack du jour. People that are at home are being targeted, and this is exactly what you see. I can tell you this, 9 people out of 10 will not fall for this. But this window right here hooked into Internet Explorer, and if this woman went to anything, any URL with the word mail in it, finance in it, bank in it, and 1,000 other keywords, this window would pop up in her browser. If she filled out the data in here, does anybody want to guess what country this data would go to? It definitely went to Russia sooner or later. It went to a compromised machine. It was a compromised website in Georgia. And the first people to shut off that website in Georgia wasn't law enforcement, wasn't the victim. It was the folks that run the DNS in the sky. And they recognized, hey, you know what? Everything's going, all this keylogger stuff's going to this machine in Georgia. So the back door actually had a fully qualified domain name hard-coded into it. So the folks that run the DNS changed the DNS tables. I'll skip this case study for time. End users is the number one way people are detecting incidents from our experience right now. I think that's very important because I think that trend's different in 1998. 34 of the last 50 times we've responded to incidents is because somebody, Jane Doe or John Doe, is just sitting at work at their desktop and they go, something smells wrong here. We've got a problem. Then they call the magic 1-800 number, guy puts on cape, swoops in, and they've confirmed that we've got an incident. And the number one way, and this is not the best way, but the number one way end users have detected a compromise is a machine crashes. So kind of interesting. to me, that's indicative of the kernel level attacks being used a little more often. If a kernel level rootkit is being run on a Windows machine, it may make the Windows machine run in an unstable fashion or a crash. Another reason why folks may not choose to run kernel level rootkits on Windows machines is that it will make them run unstable. But that's the number one detection mechanism. In fact, we ran a case about a year ago where we were helping folks out. It was the only detection mechanism. Machine crashed and we said, oh, okay, now we got a problem. If you're at work and your machine crashes, you may have been just trying to print a PDF document, but Windows is a little more robust than that nowadays. I would recommend if your machine routinely crashes, you have a hardware problem or a security incident, you should at least get a security folks to look at it. And I'll tell you that it's even more probable in Unix. If a Unix machine crashes, I would say it's a 10%, 20% increase in the probability it's a security incident. Anytime your antivirus just doesn't run, that's bad. And the frustrating thing about the rootkits that we see that shut off antivirus is that you really can't tell that antivirus isn't running. So the only way you can check is every once in a while I recommend if you open up an Office document, you should see antivirus kick off when you open up an Office document if you have it on there. And if it doesn't, that could be bad. That's when you want to investigate a little bit more. What you do next is go to Windows Explorer, right-click on the directory, say you want to run antivirus. If it doesn't run, you've got a computer security incident on your hands. Next one's kind of interesting, but we've seen it happen too often, and people have detected it this way. If you go to install a new application, and the blue shield going across your machine just doesn't finish. For example, let's say you're putting iTunes on a Windows machine, and you're doing it from a CD, and it doesn't install right. Then you download it from the internet, and it doesn't install right. You probably have a computer security incident. There's a virus or a rootkit on the system. Double-clicking on an icon, and nothing happens. Hardware problem, process hung on your machine. I recommend rebooting. If you reboot and double-click on an icon again and nothing happens, you probably have a 25% chance of a security incident on your hands. Certain applications won't run. I'm going to skip to the last one because it's a very obvious one. If you ever hit Control-Alt-Delete to see what's running on your system, I will do a sample, see if it works. Doesn't. All right, Control-Alt-Delete, that means I've been hacked, right? You hit Control-Alt-Delete on your system, and if it just flashes on your screen and then disappears, that's bad. And there we go. Machine working at blistering speeds. Hopefully that doesn't bother you if I do the rest of my presentation with Task Manager open right in the middle of the screen. Then there's the obvious detection mechanisms. If you're a U.S. contractor for the military and your website has this page on it, that is bad. And as facetious as this seems, this is a common detection mechanism that's been around for a couple years now, and these pages are very sophisticated. And it's like having an executable on a machine. It's just that it happens to be served as a web page to folks in other organizations. You know, you don't want to overthink this one. I kind of can guess where the attack came from. For those of you that cannot read the Chinese character set, what this led to is this was a front page on a compromised web server. It was a backdoor. It allowed the attackers from a browser to connect to the victim machine, run any command they want, ping systems on the inside, really do anything. They could view any file on the remote system via that page. Pretty good stuff. They're getting more sophisticated, and they're getting packed using ASPAC and other things, so it's kind of frustrating when you find these things. So what are these attackers doing nowadays? I recategorize why people attack all the time. There's attacks for money. They seem to be originating from Eastern Europe. And I'm not stereotyping here. I'm just telling you based on my experiences of looking into probably over 200 security incidents in the last 5 years, this is the trends I'm seeing. Attacks done for money are coming from Eastern Europe or Russia. Attacks that pilfer information are coming from the Asia Pacific. Attacks for access are coming from guys who want to run botnets around the world and sell them. Attractive nuisances are 15-year-olds trying to impress their girlfriends, and information warfare is the stuff we probably just don't see because we don't have sophisticated enough tools to respond to it. But it's probably growing in its commonplace rather than getting less common. When I look at attacks for money, one of the things I've noticed as a trend is they attack people sitting at home because that's where the money is. The general U.S. populace is probably the number one targeted area. U.S. credit card numbers are like currency on the internet more than any other credit card out there. What they're targeting is your Social Security card numbers, your user IDs and passwords, because I always say identity theft on the internet is nothing more than knowing my user ID and my password. Then you go to Amazon.com and buy whatever you want. I'll never notice. You can even sprinkle it amongst my three or four different credit cards. You can go to orbitz.com, buy whatever you want. You can go all over the place and buy stuff. So losing a user ID and password in cyberspace is a bad thing. And that's exactly what these guys are doing. How do they do it? There's two ways you're going to lose your user IDs and passwords for your online banking or for Amazon.com. It's either A, they hacked your system and put a keylogger on there, or B, you fell for a phishing expedition and just gave them that information, or it's a combination of both. And right now, the most common is the combination. You fell for a phishing heist, but all that phishing expedition did is sent you to a rogue website that exploited Internet Explorer or whichever browser you're using. Right now, it seems to be that Internet Explorer is having the most problems from a security perspective based on what we've responded to. Quick case study on this. I've done this a lot, but the problem is this case study absolutely fits every case we've done in this arena. We've done 7 or 8 different computer systems where people have really lost money. The evidence left behind for every one of these was almost identical. We found the keylogger, we found the keylog files, we saw the person lose their user ID and password. In May of 2004, a woman lost $20,000 from her bank account. She notified the bank right away, and the bank changed their user ID and password. The very next day, she lost just under $10,000. And I know right now you're all thinking, who the heck has $50,000 in their bank account? This must be a bogus story. She was an attorney. She really had the money. The attackers were very happy. So this is what that website looked like. With a user ID and a password, you could get into her bank account. You could pay her cable bill, her electric bill, her mortgage. It didn't matter. Or you could pay these guys in Latvia via an e-commerce transfer, and that's what was going on here. It was just payments to Latvia. When we did our analysis, we noticed that the time date stamps, you know, we just kind of looked at what files were created, modified, or accessed around the time of evil on her machine. We know that she lost her account sometime prior to May 1st of 2004. So when we're looking at her machine, we noticed that on April 30th, there was a file called sdsini.ini made on her machine. It just looked weird to us because she was running a Windows 2000 and Northward operating system, so we didn't expect to see a .ini file being made that late in life. And when we opened up this file, it was XOR encoded at the time. We decoded it, and this is bad right here. If you ever open up a file on your machine and you don't know what the heck it is because it's XOR encoded, I recommend you look for the most recurring character. That's probably space, and then you XOR over that most recurring character, and you can probably decode it pretty quickly. Use hex editors, and they'll un-XOR things pretty quickly for you. Anyway, you can see that the woman's identity problems have just started. Not only did she lose $50,000 in unlawful wire transfers, she also lost her user account and password for Microsoft.net. What does that mean? Guys can read her email. Guys can see what she's ordered. Guys can see whatever. The hackers have a lot of information there. Not only that, you can see, I put in bold, you see exactly what the woman actually sent an email back to her bank. She had just gone online and lost money. Kind of interesting how this thing worked. It hooked her browser. It only hooked Internet Explorer to do the key logging. There's spyware out nowadays that can kind of protect you from some of this. We went into what's called our restore points. What restore points are kind of a great forensic tidbit for you. Anyone running Windows 2000 and north, meaning newer than that, you have system bind restore points being made every 24 hours and made every time you install new applications, and the author of that application says, hey, make a restore point. These things allow you to revert back to a prior state should whatever you installed break stuff. So when we went through the woman's restore points, we found I think over 25 different copies. I don't have the slide in here, but we found over 25 different copies of that sdsini.ini keylog file. The attacker had named it .ini, important system file, and the attacker had stored his keystroke log file in a system root directory. And because of that, the system bind restore points were configured to back this file up every time one was made. It was kind of neat. For those who care, the keystroke log file was emailed directly to an account in Russia. The email was also XOR encoded. And the Trojan that affected the woman's machine came with an SMTP server, so the stuff was getting emailed right out. You can see we figured out how she was compromised by reviewing the esoteric Dr. Watson logs. And I highly recommend if you ever feel you have a Windows desktop that's been compromised, look at your event logs. The application event log will have any time Dr. Watson created something. And then once you see that Dr. Watson created something, find your DRWATSN32.log on your system and review it for programs that crashed. A program that crashes equals someone may have tried to attack it. Back when the Sasser worm was going around, LSAS crashed. Dr. Watson sometimes made an alert on that. Here we see Internet Explorer crashing, and it's an access violation. An access violation is when there's some portion of RAM locked by a process, some other process is trying to do an operation inside of that locked portion of RAM, whether it's trying to execute when it's a non-executable portion of RAM, or whether it's trying to read something it didn't have privileges to. Bottom line is there's an access violation, and that's basically how a buffer overflow against Internet Explorer is going to appear. I hate to say it, there's nothing prettier on Windows native. If you had a host-based firewall, you'd see something prettier. When we saw the Dr. Watson logs, Dr. Watson has a good thing. Every time a process crashes, Dr. Watson takes control of that process and stuffs the memory space for it to the hard drive in a file called user.dmp. This is a hex-based file. It's pretty ugly to look at, but you can see that when we looked at the hex dump of the user dump file, we can see that the woman, at the time she was compromised, or at the time Internet Explorer had an access violation, she's browsing her email. So now you can see how this attack took place. A woman's an email. She's accessing it via Internet Explorer. She must have clicked on a hostile link, and then rogue code was dropped onto her machine that executed the next time she rebooted. What you have on the slides right now is her in email. She's at logicmail.logic.bermuda. She's looking at her email folder, and right underneath the user agent, there's a host and a keep alive. That host was a host IP address in Russia, and right underneath the keep alive was nothing but binary code being dropped onto her system. That's bad. Attacks for information or data pilfering are kind of different, because I see end users being targeted for attacks for money, but when it comes for attacks to steal information, like we want your PDFs, we want your Word documents, we want your PowerPoints, we want your email, it's just more of a persistent, targeted, ongoing attack, and they're really searching for the crown jewels on server systems, such as a file server or a database. A couple things here. I think the number one way of access, and a quick statistic, in the last 300 systems I've personally reviewed to see if they were compromised, I can't remember the exact number, but it doesn't sound startlingly good. On the last 300 systems I've looked at, I think I knew exactly how that system was compromised 30% of the time. That means 70% of the time, I knew the system was compromised, but did not know the initial mode of entry. And usually that's because it's valid credentials. On a Windows system, if someone's got your domain credentials, they can hop from system to system, and very few people ever scour the event logs, the security event log, to know this was really Bob logging on, but this was Bob the bad guy logging on. It's just that correlation never exists. And I think valid credentials are one of the number one ways these data pilfering attacks are occurring. They have a beachhead on your network somehow, some way. They'll have a powerful and well-hidden back door to that beachhead. But from the beachhead on inward, it's all valid credentials, at least in the Windows domains. Their post-exploitation persistence is much higher than what I've seen in the attacks that just spread amongst home users that do key logging. And the reason for that is basically to continue to pilfer the data. They have to steal stuff, and that's kind of interesting as well. Right now, the hack du jour, if I hack your network and I'm pilfering data, I can't sit here and download 15 gig of data to one IP address in Asia every single day. So what they're doing is cutting everything up into chunks and sending it into different places, and then somehow it's being reassembled on the back end. The most commonly used tool to disassemble stuff being stolen from a Windows machine is RAR. People are using RAR because they can password protect the files that they're stealing so that you can't decrypt it and look at the contents of the RAR files. And RAR comes with an innate capability to slice things up. So you can RAR a file that's 2 gig in size and make it into 150 little files and then send it. It'll be encrypted, it'll be tiny, and you can push it all over the internet. Kind of frustrating. And I've noticed, I think this is a lot different than when I first started looking at computer intrusions in 1993. The speed at which attackers move is way faster than 1993 through 1998. And I've seen this in monitors. Back in 1995 or 96, if we had a network monitor at an Air Force base, bad guy got on, he'd tap dance on the system for 8 straight hours doing dumb stuff, ls-al, look at the contents of a directory. The last couple that we've wiretapped, we've seen guys come in And I'm literally probably a minute on one system, and boom, they're right off to the next one. They're moving very quick. They start operations on one, and they tend to be better trained and moving faster. Quick case study on the pilfering aspect of the intrusions we've seen. Most of the folks that are suffering from data pilfering intrusions, it's an ongoing incident. It's persistent. The resolution is a constant battle. And here you can see that the victim organization knew about the intrusion, and they tweaked their proxy logs because the only way out of their network was to go through a proxy. So they had great bottlenecks. People had to go out one of 4 to 5 different exit routes so they could see anything going to predetermined hostile domains. And they found some things. We responded to it, and I just wanted to show you a real response here. We were sitting in a room at the time when we did this response, and there's a little bit of pressure on it because there's a group of the victim organization were sitting there watching us. We were on an overhead, and they said, hey, can you respond to a machine right now out in California? So we deployed an agent in California. We reached across the network from where, you know, in D.C., pulled the data back, and Chris Kendall was sitting in the front row here, diagnosed his back door in minutes. If you look at this S-Card server program, I'm looking at all the processes running on the system, sorted by how long they've been running. So everything booted looks like 87, 14, 39, 04 seconds, minutes, hours, days. 87 days ago is when this machine booted up. So you have 87 days ago, there's a boot process. 64 days ago, there's something that we can't even see started up. You see Explorer, which is kind of like the desktop, started up 17 days and 21 hours ago. And then all of a sudden, though, we see an SVC host, process ID of 1524, started up on March 27th of 2006. I was actually suspicious of that. It doesn't make sense to see an SVC host type process running 87 days after the boot process, but we'll get to that one. This S-Card server just looked bad right away because S-Card is a smart card service. It comes with Windows 2000. It starts during the boot process. You expect it to have started 87 hours ago. If it for some reason crashed, I highly doubt a sysadmin, unless they were using those secure access smart cards, would ever notice that this thing had crashed and they restarted at this time. So we immediately said process ID 1560, and you see the big red dot next to it, could be a bad process. So the very next thing we did is said, let's look at everything created, modified, or accessed around the same time frame as this S-Card SVR.exe. And we noticed something right away that looked weird. I don't know what that second line is here, but there's a file called A with a tick over it, and that just looks like someone loaded up code, and it was a Unicode file name. Had no extension, but if you look at its size, it's 90,112 bytes in size. It's the exact same file as scardsvr.exe. The next step we did is grabbed scardsvr.exe to see if it's bad. If you look closely, by the way, it has the same time date stamps as kernel32.dll. This is absolutely the hack du jour right now on every backdoor we've seen in the last year. Someone will run the backdoor on your system after they've broken in, and the first thing the backdoor does is it'll copy itself to the system root directory wherever that happens to be on your machine. So it's usually WinNT or Windows slash System32 or WinNT slash System32. It'll place itself in that directory. It'll take the creation time and the last modified time of a commonly used file. Kernel32.dll is on every single Windows system, unless your Windows system doesn't work right. And it's there. The next thing we did is we just took a quick look at the compilation date on S-Card SVR. We had it. We used PEView. It's a freely available tool. And if you look at the compilation date, July 17th of 2005. We don't want to overthink this. This is automatically malware. If something's compiled in 2005 but has a creation date of September 5th, 2002, it's bad, period. But we overthought it a little bit anyway. We decided let's take a look at what this thing does. Took a quick look. We knew it was packed. And by the way, once something is packed, you automatically know it's bad. It's very rare that it's not. We took a look at the libraries this thing used. Anytime, kernel32.dll is always going to be imported. The advapi 32.dll, when it's imported, you look at the functions that the program uses. In this case, you see the advapi and the WinSock 32 libraries brought into play. The advapi is to read, write, and query the registry, and the WinSock is to open up sockets and communicate on the network. There are legitimate programs that do that, but not an S-Card or smart card server. So this is a program that speaks on the network, alters the registry, probably bad, and we'll skip that one. And I'm going too far. I was showing you the disassembly of it.
Bottom line is anytime you see a file copy itself or somewhere else, it's also bad. After we, just to show you the strength and power and purpose of the back doors we're seeing, this back door, after we decrypted it, allows the guy to do whatever he really wants on the system, all command line, and it's pretty nice. It allows him to put files on the victim system, take files from the system. He can reconfigure his backdoor on the fly. He can halt the system or reboot the system. Halting shuts it off. Rebooting, he'll probably do that to install something else on the machine, and he needs a reboot to get it to run appropriately. So it's pretty good on how it works. Backdoor had configuration data stored in the registry, and we're seeing that's common as well. For those of you that do disassembly, anytime you see in your disassembled dead list of code something right into the registry and it's XORing it for some reason, probably bad. Anything that borrows time date stamps from another file, which is very obvious in your disassembly, bad. But one of the things I have noticed in incident response, it takes people days to do that triage of where's the bad program, and then if they have a program that's suspicious, the moment it's suspicious to the moment they've confirmed it's bad, sometimes takes 5 to 10 days. Some of the things that we're seeing change in the incident response arena, we've found that there's a need now to acquire and analyze the contents of RAM, and there's three things that we do when we acquire RAM. We acquire all of RAM, and we do that now. Then we start acquiring specific process space on suspicious processes. One of the worst things you can do, I think, in today's land, when you're responding to a computer intrusion, is the end user shuts his machine off the minute he thinks he's been compromised. I'd highly recommend if you leave here, if you have end users and you need to give them some kind of process if they think there's been an intrusion, tell them just to unplug the network cable. That way, if it's a worm, virus, or some nuisance, it won't continue to propagate and damage your network. But at the same time, you can still get some great quality things out of RAM. The attack tools of today, they're only going to be in RAM, and there's no question that the code that we're going to see bad guys writing in the next few months and years, you're not going to find them on hard drives. Yes? In other words, native. Basically the question was, have you found any network-aware viruses? I'd say almost all of them are, because they're all polling for, is there a TCP/IP stack I can use? I'm going to use it if there is one. And then we're seeing folks that, obviously, with the rootkits, create your own TCP/IP stack in the kernel so that it circumvents all the firewalls you've put in place. In other words, the question would be, have you seen a backdoor that once it recognizes it's not on the network, it starts deleting itself? I haven't seen that, and there's a risk there, too. Bad guy doesn't know if he's on a laptop when he hacks it right away, necessarily, or a desktop, and if it shuts off or, you know, is off the network for a second, he may not want that backdoor to delete itself. Could it be done? Absolutely. It would be very simple. You could have it poll, and if it polls every hour, it's sending a beacon, and it fails 3 times in a row, wipes itself. Yeah. Self-deleting code is very, very common nowadays. We run into it a lot in the financial services when the end users and clients are getting compromised. Second thing we've noticed, there's a need to locate well-hidden user space code. That's an absolute fact. It was kind of neat in 1996 when I was in the Air Force responding to computer intrusions. Bad guys named their bad stuff 1.exe. That's easy to know it's bad. You know, okay, or evil.exe or back orifices file names. I mean, it was very easy to find this stuff. In Linux land or Unixville, it was a little bit harder to find backdoors. But nowadays, I've never seen it harder in user space. If you want to know what the backdoors are going to be called in your network, just do a Control-Alt-Delete. Go to processes and look for everything that runs a system, and that's what they're going to name their backdoors. And it's almost impossible for you to determine the difference between bad guy service running on your machine and a normal service from Windows. A couple reasons why. I'm running a standard Windows XP machine right now. I have to show you this because I'm still stunned that after years and years of doing incident response, when I do a PS service on my machine to see all the services running, I have over 90 services running on an XP box, and I don't even know what the majority of these are. Some of you might recognize your own backdoors on my system. Where this machine's been and what I've done, sometimes I just, you know, after a year, I think I just got to throw them out or reinstall via Ghost. But I don't know what all these are, and I can tell you right now, 90% of all, and maybe even higher, of the Windows backdoors are installed as services, and we'll go into detail on that. But even a very knowledgeable sysadmin may not find these, nor should they be expected to, because these are very well hidden. And that creates number 3, the need for malware triage. If you think you found something bad, let's say you work at a financial service and you got a geek in the basement, he calls you up, I think I found malware, and you're managing this guy. You really want him to tell you yes or no in about an hour. The 5 days, the 8 days, that's too darn long. And there is a way to do it pretty quickly. But right now I am seeing at times 5 to 8 days for that analysis to occur, even just to say this stuff is bad, which seems long to me. And then the rumor mill starts too, because almost every intrusion I've ever been involved with, the rumor that there's a kernel level backdoor always starts to spread every single time. And then you start really looking under the skirt there to see, hey, where is this backdoor? You never find it. It's kind of interesting. And that's because of the inability to do in-depth malware analysis. And there's a couple of reasons why that occurs. We'll get to it in a second. When I say that we need to start obtaining RAM, here's the three things that we're starting to grab. We grab physical memory using just Linux-based, well, in this case, we use DD for Windows as well. And we'll use plain DD, access the memory device, and just dump it. So if we have 2 gig of RAM, we're going to end up with a 2 gig file. No big deal. It's ugly to go through. It's probably the last thing we review on a live file system or a live system that we're responding to. We grab the page file, and the best way to do this, we'll go over in a second, but it's probably access data's tool. And then we use user dump by Microsoft to dump individual processes. In Unix, it's real simple if you need memory. Just do a cat and redirect it to a file on devkmem, devmem, or devkcore, depending on your Unix flavor. On Windows, you are going to have to use a special tool by George Garner. It is free. I highly recommend it. It has absolutely saved us. We responded to an intrusion in August of 2005, where if we didn't dump memory and look at it, we would have thought only one machine was compromised. By dumping RAM and reviewing RAM, we recognized at the time we were responding, the attacker had valid logons to 11 other systems simultaneously. None of this stuff was available to be found in user space. None of this stuff was stored on the hard drive, because guess where the logs would be for his access to these other systems? On the other systems. So we found 11 other compromised hosts just by dumping memory, which is nice, or bad if you're the victim. So easy to do by getting the swap file. The advantages you get when you dump all of RAM, or in this case just the process space, if an attacker hacks your system, whether it's Windows or Unix, even if there's an encrypted channel on the network, the commands he's typing may still be buffered in the process space, and you may actually see a full list of the commands the guys run, potentially for days. You won't have time date stamps, but traditionally, if we see a back channel coming out of the U.S. to another country, and we dump the process space to see it, we see every command the guy ran. That gives us, we know his tools, we know his techniques, we may get the command lines to very difficult processes so that we can now do dynamic analysis of them to see what their malware does. It's very frustrating to do malware analysis when you have no idea how to invoke all the options on the malware unless you have the source code. So that's how you do that. It's been, I think that if you have a process that doesn't dump RAM, I'd highly recommend start training your incident response teams to start doing it. Right now it's going to be a widget glued to something else, but it's going to work out. Here's a quick example of us looking at all the processes running and using user dump to dump suspicious processes. This is a fictional example because everyone we really did, there's attribution to the victim was. Here we have a command shell. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different rogue command shells running. There's an FTP session running. There's a netcat session running, most likely. Anything with a T underscore in front of it is our trusted toolkits responding. And you can see when we dump the command shell, we see the FTP command line. We see the address going out to probably a machine in Russia. By dumping the memory space for another command shell, we could actually see the guy do a PW dump. We saw what user accounts he could compromise based on that PW dump. And we could reconstruct this output and go to the victim and say, hey, guy ran a PW dump, probably compromised these accounts. These are the ones that we're going to want to watch on other systems. The guy did an FTP, we got his user ID and password. What in this case is really boring. In the real world, it's phenomenal. I can tell you this, Russian hackers do not have easy passwords. That's been my experience, because they use a different alphabet. Sometimes it comes back to the totally different keys. It looks amazing. I've dealt with very long, very bizarre passwords I doubt we could crack unless we dumped the backdoor shell and saw the passwords and the keystrokes used. How folks are hiding their backdoors nowadays, this is Windows specific, and Unix, it's going to be a kernel module anyway, most likely. But I just want to give you some of the names we've seen. Probably the smartest thing a bad guy can do is call his backdoor a actual process that Windows installs. Now with all the Windows digital certificates, this is going to be harder for attackers to do, but right now it's still effective. And then use an invocation where it's going to be called by SVC host. You can see we saw, I'll go through each one of these. It's actually easier. This was found in April 2006. We found a backdoor, and look what the guy does here. He basically alters the image path so that when a service is run, it doesn't call the valid executable for that service. It calls evil backdoor. So what his backdoor does, he has a copy to the driver's directory. That's always going to be there. So his backdoor files in system root, system 32 drivers. He grabbed the time date stamps of kernel32.dll. I think there's publicly available source code that's easy. People have borrowed it to do that step. He alters the registry. Specifically, he's using sysmonlog and that service to hide his backdoor. He takes the original valid service and just copies it to a different directory, by the way. And then here you can see him altering the registry so his evil service starts up every time. How would you find this if you were the victim of this? You'd use PS service, see all the services running, and you'd have to magically know, hey, the sysmonlog service is being invoked and it's calling a file in a different directory. It's not easy. SVC host, one of the more irritating things at times to deal with when you're looking into intrusions. Probably 75% of the backdoors that we're responding to now are going to appear just like this when we look at task list and see what's running. They're going to show up as SVC host for a couple of reasons. SVC host is always running, and the screen capture you're looking at is me running a task list right after I installed XP. So standard XP had 5 SVC hosts already invoked right out of the gate. And there's a whole bunch more. SVC host is invoked when a process spawns a child process. It might, if it's not given an appropriate name, it'll be called SVC host. SVC host is also an executable running in RAM that listens for calls to other executables, so it saves RAM space. They're always going to be running. You can't shake it. And here's a good use of a bad guy hiding something, and it's going to be invoked with an SVC host. First thing is that he used the service called Bits to hide his evil backdoor. Bits is on your system right now, trust me. If you're running Windows, it's a service on there. And in my mind, there's no Unix equivalent of services the same way Windows manages these things. Notice that the valid version of Bits calls a file called qmgr.dll. I don't know what that stands for. I've never invoked it. I'm confused. But I know that the attacker named his evil code qmgr32.dll. Kind of looks like a newer version. Maybe it's a little bit better. Maybe it's a 32-bit version. Who knows? But it looks innocent enough. When you do ps service config bits, what you'll see is that when the binary path name, if bits was an executable, that binary path name in this output would say c/windows/system32/bits.exe. And that's what's executed when the bits service is called. However, bits is implemented via DLL, so the DLL is going to export something to a running executable. Here what we have is service host is being used to invoke the bits service. And this is commonly found in a whole bunch of other services, and now you have to play the game of going through the registry to say, hey, bits, what is the service DLL that you run when you're invoked? And then you got to know that here's a valid one. You can see down at the bottom here, I'm moving a little arrow across here. This is a service DLL called when bits is invoked is qmgr.dll. The attacker just changed that to qmgr32.dll. Very few people will notice that. We noticed it. I don't know how. One of our guys either got lucky or he's that good. The other thing, it's kind of funny. We were looking at 10 different backdoors about a month ago, and I remember thinking, I called one of our guys and said, you know what would be really neat? Let's look at the resource section and all of these things and see what they're registered as, because there's 4 sections of every portable executable in Windows land. And one of them is a resource section that keeps track of things, such as version number. And the version for every piece of malware we've seen says that it was made by Microsoft Corporation. So me, you know, it's smart by the bad guy, but that's, you know, they think about it and they say, hey, if someone's looking at our malware, we need to say that this is something else. And the resource section could very well say something else. It's easy for them to do that. And it's actually helped us identify other tools. PS Exec by Mark Rozinovich is a very powerful tool. It's excellent to system administrators. because it allows them to sit in one place and using PSExec push patches and other executables to machines and execute them at the same time. And attackers use it as well, and attackers will change the name of it, and they'll compress it, and they'll obfuscate it, but it still says in the middle of it all, this is PSExec version blah 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 by Mark Rozinovich, and it helps us identify the tools. Another change is the need for malware triage, and you know, over the last 8 years I've been involved in a lot of training where we've taught people how to hack into systems, then we taught them how to hack into systems a little bit better with expert classes, then the procedure seemed to be, now we got to teach them how to respond to stuff. I think the next wave is, now when you respond to stuff, you got to know what the heck you're looking at it, and that's the need for malware analysis. Right now, if you talk to anybody in the financial services, they should tell you, we have found malware targeting our specific bank. And I'd be surprised if they haven't, because all the malware we've found does target the victims that we happen to be looking at. All the malware we're finding isn't triggering antivirus. All the malware we're finding is specifically effective in the environment it happens to be found in. So these are kind of neat things. Some of the questions that high-level execs always have as well after there's been an intrusion that's confirmed, how long have I been vulnerable and what the heck did I lose? And you can't answer that question without saying, well, we looked at the malware and this guy could have stolen everything. Or we looked at the malware and guess what? He wasn't doing much with it because its purpose was just to scan systems or something. Or it might, I'd be crazy, but I have found it, a backdoor that logged its use. Kind of helpful. I don't know why an attacker would do that. So these are the things that we like to do, and I try to oversimplify everything in the Cliff Notes, but if I'm looking at malware, I'm not the best at malware analysis. We got guys that can do this very well. I can tell you, if you have a .exe, a Windows-based portable executable that's been armored, it's highly probable, if you want to know 90% of what this thing does, and you've done malware analysis before, you'll know in 3 to 4 days, 90 to 95% of what it does. If you want the extra 5%, have 8 weeks at it, have 9 weeks at it, it could get real hard. And I think this process will get longer because the counter forensic techniques are going to be more known to the general public and to the folks crafting the evil stuff. But in the first couple days, maybe even the first day, you should be able to say this code could be used by bad guys and it goes into one of these bins here. Is it a network listener backdoor or is it a network listener sniffer? What's the difference? Ordinarily backdoors bind to ports, ordinarily sniffers don't, but they could. So you see raw sockets opening up for sniffers, whereas you see actual ports in the bind call for a backdoor. However, you can have a port knocking listener where it's just a raw socket sitting on a system, packet comes in and says, hey, we're here and we want you to bind to this port right now and do stuff for us. So you'll see that. Is it a network scanner? There's nothing easier from my experience than to recognize network scanners used by bad guys because it's always scan line by Foundstone. And all you have to do is the strings on it and you'll find it. Port redirectors, there's a lot of malware that's port redirection that's not publicly available, that's push or pull data, they're good. And you're going to have to do tool analysis on that, but you can see it. Password cracking, password dumping, and keylogging. I can't think of another category, but you can combine all this into one big massive mothership executable as a bad guy as well, and then you're doing a lot of analysis. I guess one more would be the annoying executable that opens up your Outlook address book and spams everybody, but those are pretty obvious. You would have noticed by then. One of the things we do during malware analysis to quickly identify, hey, this thing isn't good, it is bad, is we look at the input, the import address table just to see what libraries a file is using. And then guys that have done this stuff for a long time actually start recognizing when they're an IDA pro disassembler, they start recognizing constructs that are just notoriously bad. Like this is the assembly code to open up a raw socket. There's not a whole lot of normal programs opening up raw sockets. And by the way, by the time you're doing malware analysis, there's already something about this process, this executable, that made you think, we got to look at it. So you're already thinking it's malware. One of the other things I've noticed is when it comes to malware analysis, no commercial entity, I think it's different for DoD contractors and the military, but commercial folks want answers and they want it now, and they don't realize the importance sometimes of knowing what the malware does because it fosters more sufficient, efficient, and better remediation. So what we see at the financial services is one or two guys that have the capability to take a look at an executable, say, yeah, this is malware, here's the ports it uses, here's its host-based indicators, and here's its network-based signature. They don't get the time to do that because they're getting pulled into about 50 other things. Malware analysis can be time-consuming. Managers never understand how long it takes. And the second thing is that as advanced as it is, It just is not seen as a worthwhile task to managers. However, I would argue if you don't know the back doors being used on your network, you're going to fail in getting these guys off your network. Now, I already showed you this screenshot, but I wanted to show it to you again to show the effectiveness of malware analysis. Each one of these files that we found, and this is an analysis of, I believe, 7 different back doors, all found at one victim site. And what was interesting about these back doors, you see they're packed in different ways. There's one custom pack, the others were packed with PE Compact. But they all had slightly different signatures on the network. And as the hacker evolved and had different signatures, you got to tweak your sensors because remediation will, should you choose to remediate and get these guys out of your network, remediation will fail if you don't find every machine these folks are using. So it's imperative to be able to do this malware analysis. And by the way, this is happening today. Every one of these had a counter forensic technique, period. And they're easy ones for now, but as we do our analysis, we're always thinking, thank God they didn't do this. For example, thank God their malware didn't look to see if we were single-stepping in a debugger through the program and then change its, what its purpose was or crash the debugger that we're using. And all that's very possible and very easy. They're all password protected. They're all annoying. So I'm going to do a quick intro. I've got 12 to 13 minutes. For those of you that have never done malware analysis, for those of you who have done it, the next 9 minutes will give you the capability, in my mind, to walk out of this room saying, I don't know what this executable is, and have the ability to put it in the good bin, it's okay, or the bad bin, it's probably bad, and how we do that. Pretty exciting stuff. First thing we do when we have a file and we think it's bad, we just do what I call the boring stuff, the stuff that we have to do. And it's how big is it, what's its name, what's its MD5 sum or mathematical checksum, and a few other things. I also recommend you use PEView, which is free, and say, when was this thing compiled? That's key because, well, until this presentation, we haven't seen attackers lie about the compile date. So, and let's hope they continue to not listen to me and keep putting the real data there. Because it's very helpful to us. We now know this backdoor has been used since only July 25th of 2006. It's their current stuff. What's odd is we're normally about a year behind the compile date when we find these things in the wild. We do virus scan them. I'm not sure exactly why, other than to tell the client, hey, your AV is not going to help you here. That's all we get out of that. If you find something on your machines at work or at home and you want to know what they do, take that executable, we'll put it through Jotty.org, or you can go through VirusTotal.com. VirusTotal actually runs more virus scans. The catch is every time I found something bad and ran it through these, it didn't detect it. So, like, for example, I have a screenshot here of the file as.exe going through 14 antiviruses. None of them detected it as bad. There's a port redirector that was packed with the most common packer called UPX. So, kind of interesting. You've heard me mention armoring. I just want to quickly say what I mean by that. It could mean that there's a program that's been encrypted or compressed, and that just means that the beginning header code of this of the backdoor or the malware unencrypts itself in pieces. It's almost like steganography for executables. And it's very hard right now, if it's not a publicly available packer, to identify how it's been packed. There's so many different things folks can do with their executables. And these things all exist. You can have an executable as a bad guy where it will only run at certain times, and if somebody gets your code and tries to run it, it just doesn't work. It can reset your BIOS time and date, so it works on its victim system. But when you take it to your analysis platform, it checks your BIOS time and date and says, it won't run, won't work. And that's common. Restrictive dates where it only runs on certain timetables. Password protected is the most common. The code will not execute unless you give a password on the command line. And if you can't do the right password, then you can't do dynamic analysis. That's an easy one to get by, though. Anti-tracing is annoying. Chris, have we ever run into anti-tracing?
No.
Good. Could we build it quickly? Yes. And that'd be annoying. Anti-tracing means we're running the bad malware. We're sitting in a debugger, whether it's OliDebug or SoftDice, and as we single step, the program goes, they're single stepping, crash the debugger. Or they're single stepping through our program to see each individual step of what our program does. Let's do a different executable, different decision tree. So, anti-unpacking tools, that's fine. Here's all the packers out there if you have an interest. I'm trying to pique some of your interest. My guess right now is one of the best ways you can find compromised hosts on your organization is if you had the magic widget that went to every single file on your network and said, is it packed or not? And if it was, it's probably malicious code. Right now what we use is PEID. It's currently version 0.94, and it actually will detect 450 different types of packers being used right now. It doesn't tell you how to unpack them. That's a whole nother battle for you. But PEID is free. It's available at a site in Italy. I highly recommend it because it does recursive searching for packed executables. It's very powerful. We like it, and we use it. Unpackers are all over the place. We use IDA Pro's Universal Unpacker plugin. We use the OlliDump plugin. And after that, we kind of use whatever widget we can find that works. The most common things that being used to pack programs right now are fast, small, good. For some reason, it seems to be very common from the folks in Romania and Eastern Europe. And you need FSG or un-FSG to crack that. And I'll skip that. UPX is still common. I'm amazed it's still in use. But you need to unpack things in order to have strings work for you. And notice that all the steps I'm teaching you to determine is this bad code or good code or who knows what it is you're not executing the code itself yet. The next thing is strings. It's a public available command. I'd recommend using the one from sysinternals, now wininternals, I believe, that Mark Rozinovich wrote, because it can do Unicode searching as well, and you need that. The Cygwin version of strings does not do the Unicode searching. And I highly recommend that you do this, because when you look at the strings in a code, there might be unique enough strings that you can go out to the internet and without attribution to you, find source code or a user manual. I can tell you this, most folks that live in a lab doing nothing but malware analysis, the minute they get malware, they just get in that rut of what does it do, and they immediately open up IDA Pro and they start ripping through it. Unbeknownst to them, they have 3 days to either A, go grab the manual off a site somewhere at a university in China, or B, maybe find out that, geez, this all our data that we've lost just went to a compromised third grade classroom in Mississippi, and wouldn't it be nice to go grab that and contain it? And that's exactly what is important when you do strings, is you'll find those fully qualified domain names. We happen to do it pretty quickly. We try to maintain the discipline to always do web research that's non-attributable to us. That means we don't go right back to the hacker's IP address or anywhere near them if we can help it, and I don't know of an exception to that. But we did we went through a program that we found on a machine, and you can see every bullet here is unique strings in a program that we unpacked, and it was packed with a custom packer, so we had to, you know, basically execute it and dump RAM to get it unpacked. So you can see that there's a lot of unique strings that they spelled delete, D-E-L-T-E, Squelta 1.0, Bingle's an actual guy, I still don't know who the heck he is. But we found the source for this stuff just by doing a Google on these unique strings, and we found the manual. Now, granted, it was in Chinese, and we had to use the Google Translator to translate it, but we learned a lot about this tool, and it helped us for tool analysis just by going through this stuff. So you can see it right there. Another thing, if you're ever looking for attribution on who's hacking you, we found a file called let.exe. I did a Google for let.exe, and, well, every single site that has it had a certain character set. Disassembling tools, you have to unpack tools to disassemble them, period. So if you're a bad guy, you pack them. If you're a good guy, you got to figure out how to unpack these things. It's a common war. It's kind of like rootkit detection. If you can detect that rootkit, they up it so you can't. If we can unpack it, they update it so you can't. Same type of thing. Most commonly used tools here are PEView in my mind and IDA Pro. And IDA Pro is the staple standard because it handles ELF executables from Linux machines as well as the PE portable executable files from Windows. When you go through this, you have two options at this point. You're at a fork in the road. Do I want to do malware analysis for the next 8 weeks, get good at it, and become the malware guy? Or do I just want to have enough interest that every once in a while I kind of take a peek at it? IDA Pro, I believe, is over $2,000. There is trial versions that are very effective as well to at least help you say that, you know, certain things are bad. And there are free tools for dynamic analysis, so you may not have to do disassembly. But when you do disassembly in IDA Pro in general, you can find those following four bullets very quickly. Does something use a network? Does something open up raw sockets? Does it encrypt itself? Does it use XOR encoding? Does it write the files, read files? Does it copy itself? All these things you get used to recognizing as constructs, so you can rip through it pretty quickly. What I'm going to end up doing someday is what I'm going to call someday we have to do it. I don't want to call it the idiot's guide to malware analysis or, you know, malware analysis for dummies. That's just not right. So we're going to call it malware analysis for really smart people that work hard. And one of the things that would have to be in that book is, here's Windows APIs that when called could mean the following, and it's literally a pick list because it is that easy. I got a screen capture here using PE View. We're looking at a potential piece of malware, and we just need to know what DLLs are imported by this. Well, kernel 32, no surprise, you're going to see it. ADVAPI 32, most of the time it's called as well. But you see down at the bottom the WinSock 32 libraries. This thing's going to talk on the network. It's going to do something on the network. And then you can go and look at what specific functions are used inside of that DLL. Anytime you see something call at VAPI 32 and say that I'm going to open and set registry values, that means it's opening up the registry, and almost everything does this anyway, but at least now you know this program writes to the registry, reads from the registry, and does stuff with the registry, and you know where to look once you start looking at the dead list or disassembled code. And it's also fantastic to know when the function's being used by WinSock. And this one's very interesting. We even circled the sleep function. If you look at this, WSA cleanup, WSA socket, WSA startup are called every single time a Windows program uses this API and it's going to use the network. Fine. But you see the host to network short, HTON's call. What that means is the Intel little endian's getting flipped to network byte order. This thing's automatically talking on a network if you see the HTON's function used. INET adder. It's converting something to the IP address format we're all familiar with. Sweep, beaconing, period. That's this thing going out every hour or every 2 hours or every 30 seconds. This is a very common, just by seeing this, I magically know, I don't know of a normal process period that says, hey, I want to listen on a network and then go to sleep every once in a while and screw the people that want to tell that to me because I'm sleeping for now. This is a process that's beaconing outward to a bad guy somewhere. So it's kind of neat. And then the final bullet, and I only have 1 minute, for incident response. Because attackers are using more sophisticated tools and moving fast, we have to move faster. And I'll leave you with the last thought, and it's probably the hardest thing to do when you're managing an incident, is once incident is detected, you want to prevent the darn thing, but the only way to prevent it is you need to determine the host-based countermeasures. What ports is the guy speaking on? What's the network-based signature? And you need host-based detection and prevention mechanisms. And the problem is you don't know what those are until you start investigating. The longer it takes you to investigate, the more information you have about the bad guy, and you have better remediation. Problem is, flip that over, the longer it takes you to investigate, the more stuff you're losing, the more widespread the intrusion is, and the harder it's going to be to remediate. So you really have to work fast, have the expertise, compress the time frame in which you solve. Here's how we find this guy via host-based detection mechanisms, meaning what log files does he write to, what user accounts is he using, what registry entries are indicative of his backdoor, what are the MD5 sums of his backdoor, the file names of his backdoor, the event log entries significant that represent his activities. Whatever it happens to be, you need those. And then you also need to know, here are the strings we look for on the network, because almost every backdoor we've ever found does have a unique indication that doesn't have a lot of false positives. With that, I think we're done, and we're about to hand out a few, I'm going to just advertise the party, and I have a few books to give out. This first one, all you have to do is be the first one to answer the following question correctly. What team won the Super Bowl last year? I think the sound travels too slow from the back, so I'll ask one in the middle. Steelers, a.k.a. the best team. All right, and then this one's an easy one. What number did Rocky Blyer have? 20 is right. Someone down there. Got it. And Mike, do you want to do the giveaway for the PlayStation? What's that? Thank everybody for being here. If you have any questions, any comments, I'm going to be around.
Great job, thank you.
Thank you very much.